This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, October 1st. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Gary Niederhoff. The nation's highest court begins a new term today. Justices will hear arguments from cases on Guantanamo Bay prisoners and voting rights, among others. Egyptian newspaper editors reporting on the health of 79-year-old President Hosni Mubarak face fines and arrest. And hundreds of U.S. high school and university students walk out of classes in support of the GINA 6. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The governing military junta of Burma has for now succeeded in crushing popular dissent in the form of street demonstrations. At this time last week, the mobilizations led by Buddhist monks appeared to be headed towards a nonviolent popular uprising. The government then cut internet and mobile phone networks to the outside world and began a series of violent raids targeting the monasteries in the commercial capital of Rangoon. The United Nations has sent Special Envoy Ibrahim Gambari to Burma, but the junta has refused to meet with him for the past 3 days. Gambari met with detained pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi yesterday. The Pentagon has entered into another multi-million-dollar contract with Blackwater USA. The private security contractor today begins its first day of work on a new $92 million contract to provide aviation services in Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan, and Uzbekistan. Blackwater has come under scrutiny recently for a deadly shooting incident in a Baghdad traffic circle. The incident is the subject of an ongoing investigation. The European Commission says it will take the UK government to the European Court of Justice if it does not better safeguard individuals' personal data. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Britain was already the world's most surveilled society before a new law took effect today to force phone companies to retain information about all landline and cell phone calls. This data can then be made available to more than 700 official organisations. That includes police, security services, tax authorities, health services and local authorities. The government wants to extend these powers to cover email and internet activity too. But the European Commission has been investigating the UK for the last 3 years. They've found that Britain has only implemented 11 of the 34 articles of the European Data Protection Directive. Britain's Ministry of Justice claims they've brought the directive into law correctly. Negotiations are ongoing, and the outcome is uncertain. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Costa Ricans opposed to the DR-CAFTA free trade deal with the U.S. hit the streets of the country's capital city yesterday in a large show of opposition to the agreement, just 1 week before it faces a nationwide referendum. Nan McCurdy has more on the story.
More than 100,000 people marched in San Jose, Costa Rica, Sunday against the ratification of the Central American Free Trade Agreement. It was an unusually large demonstration for a country with a population of only 4 million. DR-CAFTA, a free trade agreement between 5 Central American nations, the Dominican Republic and the U.S., is facing a high-stakes referendum on October 7th. The second vice president of Costa Rica resigned in September amidst public outrage over a leaked memo in which he called for a fear campaign to get Costa Ricans to vote yes to DR-CAFTA. Opponents say DR-CAFTA will harm Costa Rican farmers who will be unable to compete with U.S.-subsidized agricultural goods dumped on the domestic market. Many Costa Ricans also oppose opening up the public sector to privatization. The Costa Rican government warned Thursday that if the no vote wins the referendum, they will not pursue an association agreement with the European Union. Costa Rica is the only country included in the DR-CAFTA treaty to put the trade agreement to a public referendum. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nan McCurdy.
Ecuador held landmark elections on Sunday for a constituent assembly to rewrite the country's constitution. Joseph Muti reports from Quito.
Although official results have not yet been announced, Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa, has already declared victory for his plan to implement what he calls 21st century socialism. Exit polls give Correa's party, Alianza País, 71 of the 130 seats in the new assembly, responsible for rewriting Ecuador's constitution. If the exit polls are correct, the results will be a huge boost to the president's desire to reform the country's legal and governing systems. Such proposed reforms have already been met with powerful opposition from the country's longtime ruling elites and business interests with allies in Washington. Much of the support for the Constituent Assembly comes from Ecuador's powerful indigenous population. The creation of a Constituent Assembly was put to a nationwide referendum in April and passed with a landslide approval of 81%. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joseph Muti in Quito.
Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
The Supreme Court begins a new term. The court will hear a number of high-profile cases dealing with the death penalty, detainees, employment discrimination, and voting rights. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, all eyes are on one justice.
The Honorable, the Chief Justice, and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United
States. The ceremonial opening of the Supreme Court's workday.
Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay.
Anticipation is high on this first day of the court's term, as this year will be especially significant. It's Chief Justice John Roberts' second year on the court, and they've already decided to hear a high number of policy-shifting cases. And most notably, they're coming off a year with an unusual amount of cases with a 5-4 decision. And this year is likely to be no different, with Associate Justice Anthony Kennedy to be closely watched. He's considered the deciding judge in a court with 4 staunch conservatives and 4 established liberals. Judith Schaefer is the legal director for People for the American Way.
All of these cases are going to be targeted to Justice Kennedy because he is now the quote-unquote swing vote on the court in these kinds of, I'd say, hot-button types of cases that might be viewed as political or where some folks might have an ideological agenda.
It could be up to Justice Kennedy to cast the deciding vote on cases that include the death penalty, executive privilege, voting requirements, and employer discrimination. For instance, the court will hear 2 cases dealing with discrimination in the workplace. In both cases, the employees won in the lower courts. The Supreme Court has chosen to hear the case anyway. Again, Judith Schaefer.
That causes me to wonder whether the court majority, or actually you only need 4 justices to take a case, whether the ultra-conservatives on the court took those cases to reverse them.
The conservatives have chosen to hear the case, but the outcomes could come down to Justice Kennedy. Kennedy was part of a 5-4 decision in the case Ledbetter versus Goodyear Tire Company last year that sided with Goodyear in a gender discrimination suit. The ruling diminished the circumstances that women can challenge their pay discrimination, a decision that pleased business and upset equal rights advocates. Other decisive cases it could point to Justice Kennedy, a voter identification requirement in Indiana, and a case on the constitutionality of lethal injection as cruel and humane. And on Tuesday, the court will hear a case that challenges the sentencing of crack cocaine crimes, a policy that disproportionately affects people of color. Cynthia Jones is a law professor at American University.
If everybody sort of stays towards, you know, where they traditionally are, Kennedy can either go with Ginsburg and company or he can go with Thomas and company.
Kennedy could be decisive on a case on the rights of detainees to challenge their detention in court, something that Congress took away in last year's Military Commissions Act. Justice Kennedy played a key role in the last detainee war on terror case. He sided with a majority and against the Bush administration, deciding that the tribunal system was unconstitutional. Steve Vladek is an associate law professor at American University.
Oh, I think no matter how the cases are decided, Justice Kennedy will be the swing vote. There's really just not much question given how the cases, the post-9/11 terrorism cases, have been litigated and decided thus far, that he's really in the middle of the court on this one. I think the court will go in these cases as Justice Kennedy goes.
The court will go how Justice Kennedy goes could be the theme for the 2008 Supreme Court year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Egyptian courts are cracking down on the country's independent and opposition newspapers. Half a dozen editors have been given fines and prison time in the last few weeks. Several of the editors have been accused of slandering President Hosni Mubarak. Others have been accused of spreading rumors because they reported on the 79-year-old president's health and raised the sensitive issue of who might succeed him. Ursula Lindsay reports from Cairo.
In the last 2 weeks, 7 Egyptian newspaper editors have received prison sentences ranging from 1 to 2 years. The convictions have worsened already tense relations between the country's government and its independent press. At a meeting of the journalist syndicate in Cairo last week, supporters of the condemned editors chanted slogans criticizing the president and calling for freedom of the press. All of the editors who have appeared in court work in Egypt's independent or opposition press. This press has been busy in the last few years, breaking what were once called the red lines. They've published articles criticizing President Hosni Mubarak and his son Gamal, who many in Egypt believe is being groomed to succeed his father. Ibrahim Aissa, the editor of Al Dustur, has been one of the fiercest critics of the Mubarak government. Aissa was one of four journalists sentenced earlier this month on charges of defaming the president. Today, his trial on another charge begins. Aissa's paper was one of many that reported on recent rumors that 79-year-old President Hosni Mubarak was ill. Mubarak has ruled the country for the last 26 years and has no vice president. Now, Aissa is accused of spreading rumors that disturbed public security and damaged the public interest. The accusation says the rumors made the Egyptian stock market fall and led to the loss of $350 million. Aissa faces 3 years in jail. He spoke at a press conference recently.
The independent press raised its voice as Egypt's conscience and provided a model in the last few years. It lowered the president from his position as a pharaoh or a god and made him a human being to whom we can say no and no and again no.
Dia Rashwan is a well-known political analyst. He says the discussion of the president's health addressed a widespread, genuine concern among Egyptians.
Egyptians were really very concerned about the destiny of their country. Till today, the NDP, the ruling party, never declared who will be the candidate, despite also that the health of the president is not very well. And you know that the president in this country, historically and in the actual time, playing central role. It is not a marginal position, it's central one. Everything in the hands of the president.
Part of the reason for the crackdown, says Rashwan, is that the ruling establishment can't agree on who should succeed the president. Some support his son, but many don't. In the meantime, public discussion of the matter doesn't seem to be welcome. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ursula Lindsay in Cairo, Egypt.
The son of Indonesia's former notoriously corrupt dictator of 32 years returns to court on Monday. The Suharto family is thought to have embezzled an estimated $35 billion during 3 decades of rule. The country's attorney general is suing Hutomo Mandalaputra, commonly known as Tommy Suharto, for more than $50 million that disappeared in a land-swapping scam in the 1990s. As Chad Bouchard reports from Jakarta, the case may be Indonesia's last and best hope for justice. State prosecutors in Indonesia accused Tommy Suharto of giving valuable state land to his own company in a sweetheart deal.
He was convicted for the corrupt scheme in 2000 and sentenced to 18 months in prison, but the dictator's son then went into hiding for more than a year, and he hired assassins to kill one of three Supreme Court judges who had ruled against him. He was convicted on murder charges in 2002, but served just a fraction of his 15-year sentence. Leading human rights activist and member of the Indonesian human rights group PBHI, Hendardi, says it's possible the murder may have a chilling effect on judges.
There is some fear among the judges about these possibilities, but I think it's the responsibility of the state to protect the safety of judges in Tommy Suharto's case so that this sort of thing won't happen again. I think it was also a mistake that in the old days, during the time of the previous case, the legal process didn't seriously punish Tommy in the killing of the judge.
Civil and criminal cases against former President Suharto himself have failed. The 86-year-old faced graft charges in 2001 but evaded prosecution because the court declared him too ill to stand trial. The chief civil case against him, a $1.5 billion lawsuit to recover misused charity funds, resumed last week after several postponements. Current President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono was elected on an anti-corruption platform, but a recent Transparency International survey indicates Indonesia is still considered to be among the most corrupt countries in the world. Todung Mulya Lubis with the agency's Indonesia office says that perception is supported by the country's failure to prosecute high-profile corrupt officials.
Probably he's one of the most corrupt and rich former presidents in the world. I think there should be way to go after Suharto and his asset, but we have given him so much time. If we want to fight corruption consistently, we are not giving good signal to the society.
Surprisingly, many Indonesians appear quick to forgive the Suharto family. Since the fall of the dictator's regime and economic crisis in 1998, Indonesia's economy has foundered and corruption has been decentralized. As an ice cream peddler rolls through the Suharto family compound in the upscale neighborhood of Menteng in central Jakarta, Juwita says life was better under dictatorship in spite of the graft.
Even though he was pretty corrupt, when Suharto was president, essentially we didn't have a hard time. Now even milk is expensive. It's hard on little kids. In some places, lots of mothers are giving rice water instead of milk, and they're burning wood instead of kerosene.
But student Handika Sugianto says he's fed up with what he sees as the Indonesian court's privileged treatment of the Suharto family.
Maybe Tommy will be punished, but it won't be a fair punishment. Maybe 1 or 2 years. While if you steal a motorcycle or use drugs, you could be put away for years. He committed a social crime, so he'll only serve 1 or 2. And in a nice prison at that.
In a surprise move last month, Indonesia's top court awarded former President Suharto millions of dollars in a defamation suit against Time magazine for an article alleging billions of dollars in family funds were hidden in overseas accounts. The ruling sends another grim signal to those hoping for democratic progress and justice against the Suharto family. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Chad Bouchard in Jakarta.
"We all live in Gina" was the rallying cry for students across the country today who walked out of classes in solidarity with the Gina Six. Andalusia Knoll reports from New York.
Hundreds of universities and high school students in cities including Pittsburgh, New York, Los Angeles, and D.C. took to the streets today to demand that all charges be dropped against the Gina Six. This case is a story of six black male students in Gina, Louisiana, who were involved in a schoolyard fight after fellow white students hung three nooses in a tree. The six black students were charged with attempted murder, while the white students received little punishment. Their case has become emblematic of the racism that runs rampant in the criminal justice system. Rosa Clemente, an organizer of the Walkout with the Malcolm X grassroots movement, explains the phrase, "We all live in Gina."
There's Gina Sixes all over. They might be called Oakland Eights or Flatbush Sevens or Baltimore 12s. I mean, this is just another case of particularly young African-American men, Latino men also, but in this particular case, young African-American men being caught up in a racist criminal system.
Tanjaway, another student organizer with the Malcolm X grassroots movement who participated in the walkout, believes that youth need to play a strong role in this fight for racial justice.
Students need to form and become a collective so that we can be not necessarily reactionary, but we can be kind of productive and proactive about things, and knowing that racism and capitalism and all these oppressive institutions are part of our everyday reality and part of our society, and that the only way that things are going to change is that if young people all across the country and really all across the world unite and come together and become a strong and powerful force.
In addition to demanding that all charges be dropped, students are also calling for an investigation of District Attorney Reed Walters, the judge, and school superintendent handling the case of the Gina Six. In New York City, this is Andalusia Knoll reporting for FSRN.
The Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute, a group working to empower Latino youth, is meeting with Latino lawmakers in Washington. For many of the young people present, education is at the top of the agenda. FSRN correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
Texas Democratic Congressman Charles Gonzalez was among roughly 15 members of Congress who were a part of this week's conference. A member of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, which now has more members than ever before, Gonzalez says the caucus can become much stronger.
So our clout is there in a way, but I still think it has to filter down to our numbers in our communities. We need more people to be registered. We need more people to vote. In the final analysis, it's always going to be the polling booth.
The Latino population nationwide is estimated at over 44 million, and it is the fastest growing minority group in the country. Capturing the votes of newly eligible Latino voters is the main reason for the conference. The gathering is hosted by the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute, or CHCI. The group was founded 30 years ago to empower young Latinos through education. A quarter of Latinos only have a ninth grade education, and only 9 out of 100 Latinos have a college degree. The Institute has trained Latino community leaders, activists, and CEOs across the U.S. Congressman and chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, Joe Baca, says empowering young people helps to combat voter apathy.
And then in each of these areas, that means that we have role models. And that means that there are pioneers that are willing to open the doors for others. And that's important to know that, hey, you know what? Somebody is there being a voice for us. Someone is there willing to stand up and fight for us. And I think you're seeing that here at the national level.
Health issues, the environment, and banking were all topics discussed, but education was the main topic on people's minds. Maria Lisa Ocampo is one of 35 current Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute interns in Washington. She says the Hispanic Caucus will suffer unless its education problems are addressed.
Being an integral part of the community, you have to have education. You have to have people within all parts of the business world, the technology, housing, all these sort of issues that are affecting our community. We have to have Latinos involved in these things so that we can better identify how to address the issues in our communities.
Congress is in the process of reauthorizing President Bush's No Child Left Behind law. Reg Weaver, the president of the National Education Association, told the conference that he supports the law, but that the administration neglected minority communities in carrying it out.
But since then, the administration has failed to deliver many of the things that were promised in the bill. They have failed to deliver on smaller class sizes, failed to deliver on quality preschool programs for every child, failed to deliver on programs for students who need special help, including English language learners.
Weaver says the bill's best accomplishment was to show that America is failing minority students. A study by the National Assessment of Education Process shows that Latino and African American high schoolers have reading and math skills at the level of white middle schoolers. Weaver says the Congressional Hispanic and Black caucuses will play key roles in making sure Congress fixes education pitfalls in minority communities. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Lazo in Washington.
The French authorities are using increasingly hardline tactics to deport asylum seekers. President Nicolas Sarkozy has set a quota for 2007 and wants 25,000 undocumented people out of France by the end of the year. An Albanian family from Kosovo was recently dragged out of a Marseille retention center by soldiers in the middle of the night and flown out of France in a military plane. Annette Gartland reports from Saint-Jean-du-Gard.
The French authorities are using increasingly hardline tactics to deport asylum seekers. President Nicolas Sarkozy has set a quota for 2007 and wants 25,000 undocumented people out of France by the end of the year. Last week, an Albanian family from Kosovo was dragged out of a Marseille detention centre by soldiers in the middle of the night and flown out of France in a military plane. When she heard news of the Albanians' expulsion, Chechen asylum seeker Zulfia Atayeva and her four children went into hiding.
I want to stay here. It will be better for my children. I am afraid. I have nightmares. I don't know what will happen to me, what will happen to my children.
Zulfia fled her home in Dagestan in 2006 after being raped and beaten by men who came looking for her husband, who is now missing, believed dead. Peggy Campbell, a teacher from the network Education Without Borders, says that when Zulfia was interviewed by OFPRA, the organisation that handles asylum applications, she felt intimidated.
The person who took her statement was a man, and he was Russian, and the men who assaulted her were Russian. Talking about the rape was already very difficult for her, and it was even harder to talk about it to a man, not least when he had the same nationality as the men who had put her through such torture.
A doctor has certified that Zulfia's statement about her assault is true. Campbell again.
Elle a eu des fractures au bras.
She had arm fractures, and these were caused by the men who attacked her. But even the doctor's certificate was not accepted as proof that she had been assaulted.
Despite the doctor's testimony, Zulfia's asylum request was refused because she couldn't say where her husband or her parents were. She was told that her story was vague and not credible. She has now been told to leave the country and all her appeals against the order have been rejected. Zulfia's hopes were revived when Chechen aid organizations in France tracked down her parents, who do have refugee status. This is a new element which gives Zulfia the right to ask for her case to be re-examined. Zulfia's oldest child, Akram, aged 11, is afraid to go back to Dagestan.
I remember things like when men came to our house in masks. They came for my father. I want to stay here in France.
Zulfia fears for her children's lives if they are forced to return to Dagestan.
I can't sleep. It's very hard. I don't want my children to live through what I have lived through. I've lost my husband, but I have found my mother and father. I want to stay here with them. I want my children to be able to go to school without being afraid.
Until Zulfia's new asylum request is accepted, the Atayeva family risk immediate expulsion. Peggy Campbell was close to the Albanian family who were deported to Kosovo on September the 20th.
The father was accused of spying for the Serbs. He was arrested and tortured, and his wife was raped. They fled and spent all their savings. They have nothing left. All their requests for asylum were refused. They were arrested and taken to a detention center in Marseille. At about 5 in the morning, the military came and took them to a plane. The eldest girl, Liridona, who was 13, tried to fight them off. She was terrified of going back to Kosovo. She knew very well what could happen there. The soldiers handcuffed her and attached her ankles. I saw the children a few days before they left the village. They were in an indescribable state of stress. Liridona was deathly pale. She hadn't eaten or slept for 3 days. She told me how distressed and afraid she was, and it was very painful to see her like that and to feel powerless to do anything.
The French government wants to bring OFPRA under the umbrella of the Immigration Ministry rather than Foreign Affairs. Amnesty International and other campaigners have condemned the proposal and say it will create confusion between asylum and immigration in general. Asylum is a fundamental human right, Amnesty says, and must be respected whether or not a government wants to control immigration rates. There has been a drop in the number of asylum applications in the past 2 years in France. In 2006, the number fell to just over 39,000. As compared with more than 59,000 in 2005. Excluding accompanied minors, just over 7,300 asylum seekers were granted refugee status in France in 2006, as compared with just over 13,700 in 2005. Sarkozy has hailed the decrease in applications and wants to reduce the time allowed for asylum seekers to appeal against refusal. Refugee organizations say the number of requests is falling because asylum procedures are becoming increasingly complex and dissuasive. Several French mayors have declared their support for asylum seekers in symbolic ceremonies, but they have been warned that such actions are illegal. From Saint-Jean-du-Gard, this is Annette Gartland for FSRN.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Monica Lopez and Turna Gusey produced today's broadcast. Leon Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Antonio Ortiz and Rose Katabshi. For archives of this or any other newscast or documentary, go to our website, www.fsrn.org. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Gary Niederhoff.